This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, November 17th, 2010. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. It isn't difficult to find examples of poor business practices in the news. From Enron to Wall Street, a negative business narrative has been developing. Ted Malik, author, scholar, and documentary producer, believes that narrative can be and must be changed. He has written several books about the philosophy of business, including Spiritual Enterprise, Doing Virtuous Business, and Thrift, Rebirth of a Forgotten Virtue. He also produced a documentary that will air nationally on PBS in January titled Doing Virtuous Business. The film profiles 14 current or former CEOs about virtue and business ethics, including two with Northwest Arkansas ties, John Tyson and Don Soderquist. Last night, Ted Malik screened a preview of the film and then participated in a panel discussion in conjunction with the Tyson Center for Faith and Spirituality in the Workplace at the University of Arkansas. It's part of a national 26-city tour this fall. Before all of that, he came to the Carver Center for Public Radio to talk about virtue, business, and the negative business narrative that seems prevalent.
Well, I guess it's true of the news in general. A lot of people would say that there's never any good news. It's a truism. But in the business media in particular, you know, except for some business congratulatory magazines, perhaps, there has been an overwhelming amount of negative news, some of it well-deserved. So I don't want to suggest that this shouldn't tell the story of Enron or that there was nothing wrong at Lehman Brothers or that the recession didn't happen. But it seems that there is a kind of overwhelming negative, and that means that the positive never gets the attraction that it deserves.
You've written about, you have produced a documentary now about doing virtuous business. Virtuous business, which you say relies on ancient virtues in a modern world.
Yeah, so how classic that something old could be new, or that something old could be good, or even fashionable again. And that's the response I'm getting, that thoughts as old as Aristotle, or even older, and thoughts that are present actually in every spiritual tradition known to human beings, which are more than a few thousand years old, might have practical wisdom for management. It sounds like a novel, even a kind of curious idea, but it happens to be the case, and sometimes you have to take a step backwards to go two step forward.
Virtues such as compassion, as honesty, as dealing with people fairly?
Well, all of those, and just the discussion of virtue actually is the right track. In philosophy, this is called virtue ethics. So it's different from a different school of ethics that, you know, would look at duty or responsibility. So this then looks at those parts of character that are formed in the human person that congeal when people come together to attempt any kind of activity. It could be personal action. It could be action in groups and voluntary associations and churches, obviously in something called the polis and in politics. But I think very relevantly, it also has to do with corporate life. Corporations are, after all, whether it's cemetery societies or universities, whether it's for business, profit, or not-for-profit, are really the way we organize ourselves in this latter part of the 20th and now 21st century.
Is it as simple as saying you do good? You do good things?
It is. You know, that's the tradition in philosophy is a eudaimonic one, which means it has to do with human happiness and the good life and how is the good life lived. So it's a deeply personal question. It's obviously one that has to do with culture. And in our culture presently, corporations play a large part of that culture, not just internally, because each company has its own corporate culture, but so too in the way that capitalism itself is formed. And I would say that's an evolutionary thing.
This work, whether you're General Motors or DuPont or SIDS, filling station?
Indeed. So what I'm talking about here is true for mom and pop, for the small and medium-sized enterprises, which are, of course, very important to our economy, where jobs are being created, and also for the large Fortune 1000 companies. So I think that this is a kind of universal conversation. Whether, you know, it can be more easily done in a small company or a large one, a public one or a private one, in one industry as opposed to another, in a for-profit as to a not-for-profit, all very interesting research questions, but highly relevant.
You write about spiritual capital. Spiritual capital, we know what capital is. We know what a business wants capital. What is spiritual capital?
Spiritual capital is something that I've become associated with, and therefore have to defend, it seems.
Defend it?
Well, articulate it in some ways. I would frame it this way. Robert Putnam, who is a very, very well-known, some people would say the most famous social scientist of our time at Harvard, has written about social capital, you know, the fund of knowledge, the fund of connections that come together in networks that give rise in, you know, any society, in any community for that matter. He's written more recently, this book has just come out, about something that he calls spiritual capital, that I call spiritual capital. His book is entitled American Grace, to plug his book, his new book. But spiritual capital would be that part of social capital that emanates from some kind of religious or spiritual tradition. I'm not naming a particular one, and obviously in North America there have been, you know, Christians, Jews, and Muslims all forming various forms of cultures, giving rise to all kinds of organizations. But if you look back over the long spans, look at all the things that have been formed in that framework. Most of the universities, many of the hospitals, many of the associations, all kinds of voluntary activities, you name it. So, too, it has been the case that various companies have been formed growing out of or based on some of the virtues of those traditions.
Can you be a successful company for a long period of time if you're bankrupt of spiritual capital?
Well, there are all kinds of conditions that have to do about the durability of corporations, most of which have to do with serving the customers. But you could argue that those companies that take seriously the values, and in many instances they start with a kind of spiritual value, have a special condition in the economy, that they tend to do better. They are oriented not just solely at profit, which is an interesting kind of point. And they, if you look at them over a long period of time, tend to last longer. So it leads to a bunch of curious research questions about why that could be, how they got formed, which virtues are most evident. And then, indeed, to your question, if we're not producing those kinds of spiritual values or virtues any longer, what will the companies be like that we, in fact, invent and that enterprises start today?
In the documentary that you're screening while you're in Fayetteville doing virtuous business, you highlight about a dozen companies and leaders of those companies.
There are actually 14 companies in the PBS documentary, we argue in the case of these 14 companies, there are different vignettes featuring each company and most of them at the CEO level, that there are 14 different virtues, that no one company, like no one human being, is perfectly virtuous, but that they give evidence of different virtues, that they exhibit them well. So we look at those in some detail in the film. The vignettes are short, you know, you're constrained by television time, 3 minutes, 3.5 minutes, and we try to explain powerfully and visually, and then we interview all these CEOs, what makes those companies tick.
You've written a book about thrift, mm-hmm. and how that is perhaps a value that maybe the country doesn't have as much as we or it used to.
Yeah, I wrote a book just before the financial crisis, and then the book came out right in the recession, so I jokingly say I timed it. Either I timed it perfectly or I caused the condition. But the subtitle of the book is Rebirth of a forgotten virtue. So I think in the case of thrift, which I would argue is a secondary virtue, an important one and one that we have disregarded, it in large part came to have pejorative meaning, you know, a thrifty cheapskate or, you know, cheap bastard, whatever, that in the recession we have more or less come back to the virtue of frugality and said that either a simpler life or a life that has more meaning or a set of practices that are more thrifty. Actually, the word thrift and thriving are from the same root Old Norse verb, so maybe they have to do something with each other. I think that thrift has become, again, quote, the in thing.
It would seem like it would be hard to find someone to disagree that being virtuous is not that it would seem like you would have many subscribers. Yes, it pays to be virtuous. And I mean that both literally and figuratively. Mm-hmm. You'd be hard to find someone who argues against virtue, I guess, is what I'm saying.
You do find hardened people who, I'm not saying they defend vice, which would be the opposite of virtue, but they would say they would be dismissive of the virtues. And that could take one or two or three different forms. People could be cynical, for instance. Mm-hmm. People could be skeptical. Show me the evidence. Other people could say, and I think they would be correct in saying, that this is all very hard to practice, and therefore, because of human beings, you know, failures or ineptitude or original sin or whatever category, that virtue is not irrelevant. It's just hard to do.
Hard to do when you're balancing the books and trying to stay in business. Hard to do in that way.
Hard to do in every sense. That I'm thinking of BP as I'm looking at you. You could cut the corner and make an extra buck. You could not tell the whole truth all the time. You could maybe steal a little bit from your office, and nobody would ever really notice. And you add all that up, and it actually has economic consequence.
You're halfway through this tour of 26 different places. Do you find that the people that come see the movie, the people that come participate or listen to the panel discussions, are as optimistic as perhaps you are? I mean, these are not the most robust times.
Indeed. And I would say there are different kinds of audiences, and all across this country. Last week, I was at four cities and four business schools in Canada. So there are differences. I would say the MBA students that have seen the movie have been even inspired by it, because in many of their classes, they haven't heard all this, either because they're learning very specialized things, or they don't study business ethics, or they case studies that they read don't talk about these things. So they have been actually over the top about hearing some of this dialogue about virtue. People who are in business, again, large and small, all kinds of businesses, I think are also very pleased to see this movie and to have this discussion, because most of them are struggling, both individually and corporately, to be virtuous, to do good. And they're trying to work for and be in companies and in communities that exhibit some of those virtues. They're realistic people. I mean, they, you know, sun shines and the rain comes down on all of them equally, and they, they have different approaches. But it's been very well received, and hopefully when it shows, which will be sometime around the first week of January on PBS to 150 stations nationally, 15 million people, there'll be a big national kind of conversation about the virtue of business.
And I was going to ask my last question, don't you think there should be a national conversation about virtue in business, in politics, in journalism?
I think it's timely. I mean, these are perennial and timeless questions. So if I'm in some way pushing that conversation forward, then it does, you know, have ramifications that go beyond business and certainly go beyond any given state or any given country. And it has a spillover into certainly political life and cultural life, and Maybe more conversation about virtue would be healthy.
Ted Malik is chairman and CEO of the Roosevelt Group and author of several books, including Spiritual Enterprise, Doing Virtuous Business, and the producer of the documentary Doing Virtuous Business that will air nationally on PBS in January. Last night, he screened the documentary and participated in a panel discussion in conjunction with the Tyson Center for Faith and Spirituality in the Workplace at the University of Arkansas. For more information about the documentary, you can go to doingvirtuousbusiness.com. And to hear more from our conversation, look for the link at ozarksatlarge.com.
Thanksgiving is approaching, and maybe for the first time ever, you are having second thoughts about a turkey-centric feast. For help, reach for the newly published Meat Lover's Meatless Cookbook, Vegetarian Recipes Carnivores Will Devour. Jacqueline Froelich caught up with the author in Eureka Springs on her national book tour stopover in Arkansas and brings us her story.
Kim O'Donnell rips a bunch of dark green kale in the culinary suite at the Writer's Colony at Dairy Hollow.
I'm going to make kale chips. Actually, I have one for you to try. These are my version of a potato chip, and you can hear they have, I mean, doesn't that sound like a potato chip?
She's tossed the raw kale with a bit of olive oil, salt, and spices, roasted it in the oven at 350 degrees, and ended up with a bowl full of crunchy green chips. Kim O'Donnell is preparing an array of samples from her new Meatless Lover's Meatless Cookbook for a reception being held this afternoon in the Writer's Colony Great Room.
You know, you might actually get the kids to choose these instead of Lay's, right? Can't just have one. So I'm preparing more of those. And I've got some onions on the fire that I'm going to use to make a filling for what I call crostata. And a crostata is sort of like a freelance tart, very rustic. And then I've actually got something for you to try is my roasted eggplant lentil caviar. So I cooked green lentils, very basic brown khaki lentils with carrots, onions, red wine, some thyme. And then I'm mixing them with the roasted eggplant, which is pureed, with garlic, lemon, and olive oil. So again, another simple combination. So these two will actually be mixed together, and then it's a spread, which is just fab. Yeah.
The journalist turned chef brims with laughter as she roves the kitchen in her white apron, stirring a skillet of simmering onions and butter and slicing fresh baked bread. Maybe she's happy because she's managed to successfully blend both of her passions, writing and cooking. The former Washington Post Daily Web columnist now has a new column appearing in USA Today, launched just this month, called Simply Family Kitchen, on how to sway readers toward cooking rather than nuking.
I really like to cook simple food. My food is not fancy. It really does focus on what's available seasonally and wherever I live or wherever I am for that period of time. The meatless cooking, though, has definitely become part of my practice. I mean, I'm now eating meatless probably 50% of the time compared to just 2 years ago. And so the food in my book is the food that I'm making at home with my husband.
That would be Russ Walker, a special projects editor for Politico. He's also her top recipe taster. The Meat Lover's Meatless Cookbook targets those who either scoff at vegetarianism or envy it. The 230-page softcover book is divided into seasons, providing 52 complete meals for one day out of the week. O'Donnell, who lives in Seattle, tested many of her recipes right here in the culinary suite at Dairy Hollow after winning a fellowship last year.
I went home to celebrate Thanksgiving with my husband, and I came back like a week after Thanksgiving and was here for the first half of December. So it was a total of a month last fall. And again, so productive. Great. There's something energetically here that kept me very grounded. I mean, I worked like a banshee, but I felt like it was all good. You know, I walked every day. I went to yoga in Eureka. I got a massage regularly at Suchness Spa with Kat. I made good friends here. Great combination.
That alchemy must have worked. The book published this September is getting positive reviews in all sorts of magazines, newspapers, and popular websites with total foodie names like Eatocracy, Endless Simmer, and Foodista.
It has to be really delicious first, the most important thing. And that's why there's actually no fake meat in the book, because I don't want to... You know, if I'm trying to encourage people to take one day off from meat, why do we have to pretend that we're having meat on that day off? Here's a great argument. Taste the food. It's totally delicious. Oh, yeah, there's no meat in this.
O'Donnell, however, is a professed carnivore. On the flip side of her business card is a picture of her as a baby in her high chair teething on a greasy T-bone. But she's had her sights set on this book for some time as a practitioner of an emerging food trend known as Meatless Mondays, as well as a personal trend towards vegetarianism. The inviting cover of the Meat Lover's Meatless Cookbook features a rich, crusty loaf of bread sliced and stuffed with grilled veggies and melty cheese. Inside are complete vegetarian meals centered around things like lasagna, stuffed peppers, ratatouille, gumbo, even shepherd's pie. Aside from tempeh hoagie, tempeh is a fermented soy cake, most everything else is really familiar and doable for any carnivore to try.
My book is different in that I'm structuring it by menu rather than by course. So instead of the standard soup, salad, app, main, I'm looking at this completely from a meat eater's perspective and saying, I'm going to walk you through this. So I've created menus so that you don't have to freak out on how to like take one recipe from one chapter and another and pair them together for dinner. And, you know, eventually I hope that you'll get more confident and you'll want to do that mixing and matching. But for now, so the book is structured so that if you wanted to take one day off from meat, once a week, for an entire year, you would have a different menu to try.
The book is also philosophical, but within limits.
Meat eaters in particular could stand to, you know, not just poundage, but taking, just reducing meat. We eat like 200 pounds of meat per person a year, and that's an average. And it, in some cases, you know, in meat-heavy country, right here in the middle of the country, we're talking closer to 250. That's a lot of meat for our bodies to digest and process. So I look at this more as dietary diversity. You know, let's make a little bit more, let's have some real estate on the plate that's a plant rather than a chop. And let's make room for some veg and whole grains and, you know, maybe some legumes or beans. You can still have your meat on those other days, but maybe shrink the meat portion or try this idea of going one day off. I certainly feel better. The most mainstream example I can think of right now is, you know, the former governor of Arkansas, Mr. Bill Clinton, went vegan 2 months ago, lost 24 pounds. You know, Mr. Cheeseburger, right?
Data show that Americans who eat more fruits and vegetables are likely to have reduced risk of chronic disease, including stroke, type 2 diabetes, and certain cancers. Plus, eating green is green. Animal protein production's been chronically linked to both water and air pollution via concentrated animal feedlot operations.
I try not to be a downer in the book because, most importantly, I want people to get into the kitchen. You know, meat less, meat filled. Let's do it. You know, we're not cooking enough. So that's my, if I was going to get on my high horse about anything, it'd be let's cook a little bit more than we do.
And who knows, after reading this book, you may even opt for Meatless Tuesdays. Reporting for Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
To learn more, visit kimodonnell.com. This is Ozarks at Large. The University of Arkansas Wind Symphony is performing at 7:30 tonight at Baum Walker Concert Hall. Ozarks at Large's P.J. Robowski spoke with conductor W. Dale Warren about the concert earlier this week. Warren says the performance is being dedicated to the memory of a student who passed away from brain cancer in August.
The repertoire selection is based on Tony Collins because we're doing this concert in memory of his life, and it's a celebration. It's certainly nothing that would be sad because Tony was one of the most vivacious young lads we've ever had as a student on the university campus. So the opening fanfare is probably the most famous fanfare that anybody knows, the fanfare for the Vienna Philharmonic by Richard Strauss. And Tony was a very elegant and yet athletic lad, and very tall in stature. And we felt like this fanfare would put you in the right frame of mind for his personality and for the way he carried himself.
And if it's Richard Strauss, you know there are lots of instruments, and it's plenty loud.
It's six trumpets, eight horns, six trombones, two tubas, and two sets of timpani, yes.
See? Yeah.
Yeah, it's wide open. We take it out of Bulldog. We go into fifth gear in the Lamborghini on this one.
Well, that's great, because that way everybody's ready. They're in their seats, they're awake, they're pumped, they're ready for a great concert.
They won't need to go to Starbucks or Common Grounds prior to the concert, I promise.
Okay.
The next tune is Divertimento for Band by Vincent Persichetti, and I wanted to do a divertimento because it's light music, it's happy music, it sings and dances, and that was absolutely Tony. He was always had a song in his heart and just a very effervescent young man. And so this divertimento is the one of my favorites, and certainly one of the finest one in our repertoire. So that's why we chose it.
And wasn't Persichetti kind of a Renaissance guy anyway?
He wrote in the classical style, even though he didn't die until 1987. Mm-hmm. But he taught at Juilliard,
right,
and was professor of composition there for a long, long time. But did write in a more Renaissance and more classical period style. And he's very well known for his choral music and his organ music. He was a really fine organist in his own right. So, but he wrote for everything.
Didn't he even start? I mean, as a kid, didn't he even begin with the organ, I think?
He did, yes. Yeah. That's exactly right.
And that's probably
you know
why.
You're Persichetti, I'm impressed.
Well, occasionally, yeah. At this moment, yes.
Well, our guest artist, we normally save our guest artist till later in the program, but we felt like that we would put Dr. Rhonda Maines next because the piece that she chose is a piece that Tony played in recital here.
Oh, okay.
And so since he studied with her and he revered her as his teacher, we felt like it would be appropriate for her to play in a piece that he had come to love and performed himself. So we're doing the Kent Kennan Night Soliloquy, and it is absolutely a stunning work, and Rhonda sounds amazing on it. So I hope everybody will come out tonight just to hear her play, because she says she may not be able to get through it because obviously she's going to be thinking about Tony. Aww. But I promise she will. Tony, like pretty much everybody else in the wind band world, loves Percy Grainger.
Everybody loves Percy
right.
Grainger.
He's the second most played band composer in America behind John Philip Sousa, which wouldn't surprise anyone.
No.
And so there's a beautiful little setting or kind of a little suite that Chow Ragsdale on our faculty put together of Children's March, which is, one of his most famous pieces. And then, Grainger did a trip to Scotland, and he did a lot of research. And so this next little thing is one of his Scotland things that he got out of Songs from the North. And it's Ye Gang to the Highlands, Lizzie Lindsay. And I don't do Scottish very well, but it's
better than I.
It may be one of the prettiest things he's ever done, and I even include Irish tune in that.
Oh.
It's just a cool little tune, and it bounces around. And then As Sally Went A-Weepin' is the closer, and so it's the tune that reminds me the most of Tony, actually. So that's why we chose that. And then Tony's very favorite composer is John Williams. And
okay.
His favorite piece that John Williams ever wrote is the Midway March.
From the Midway.
You betcha. From the movie, exactly.
Yeah, and that back then, that was in the early or mid-70s, and that's when Williams was known as Johnny Williams.
Correct. You really do know your stuff. Yeah, he wrote that in 76, and it is the movie score.
Right.
And it's really spectacular music. And all the students looked at me when we got to the Superman theme because they just assumed that he had written that for the Superman movie and didn't realize that the Superman theme came out of the Midway.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, so it's kind of fun to hear some of the licks that Williams used later on in the Midway.
We tend to borrow from our past.
We tend to, if it works particularly.
Exactly.
And anyway, that's the first half. So, you know, that's a pretty full first half. Right. We're going to take an intermission so everybody can go out and collapse and we can charge the paddles and you know, revive everyone. And then we're going to come back. The thing that is, if to know Tony Collins was to know his faith. And he was one of the most spiritual young men I've ever had the pleasure to know. And so the piece that represents that for me is a piece called Peace of Mind by Dana Wilson. And it's a very thought-provoking piece. It's about how the human mind works. It's about emotion. It's about things beyond this world in many ways. And so you can spell it P-I-E-C-E or P-E-A-C-E.
Okay.
It is a pun on both those terms. And so this is a really large work. It's a 24-minute piece. And I think it wraps up Tony's essence more than anything else we could do for him. But if you ever met him, you knew how strong his faith was. And that's why this piece is on the program tonight. And then we're going to close as upbeat as humanly possible with The Circus Bee by Fillmore. And I had to, this is a bit of a stretch, but Tony was very proud of his very bright yellow Mustang. And so The Circus Bee, obviously you think of yellow when you think of the bee, and you think of how Tony drove his car, which was fast. And this piece goes fast.
Well, and it's by Henry Fillmore, right?
That's correct.
Now, Fillmore also, and this reminds me of his car as well, because, you know, Fillmore is known for marches. And then a term I wasn't familiar with before, Screamers.
Oh, sure, absolutely. Circus Screamers, right.
Yeah, Circus Screamers. So when I think of, you know, I think of him screaming down the street in his yellow Mustang.
Well, that's him. And he had a Camaro in Alaska. He's from Alaska, but obviously you're not going to drive from, you know, Alaska to Fayetteville. And so he left the Camaro in Alaska, and they got him the Mustang here. So he had two hot cars, no matter what location he was in.
Wow. Well, it sounds like an incredible concert. It's going to be a lot of fun. And all again, it's dedicated to the life and memory of Tony Collins. The performance is tonight at 7:30 at Walton Arts Center in Baumwalker Hall. I'm not sure, but will there be tickets at the door, do you think?
Oh, absolutely, sure.
Okay, so tickets at the door. The concert begins at 7:30, so if you're going to buy your tickets at the door, try to get there a little bit early so that they can begin on time. It's the University of Arkansas Wind Symphony, directed by Dale Warren, director of concert bands. And Rhonda Maines will be the featured artist as guest artist as flutist, and the U of A Brass Choir, conducted by Brandon Holtz.
Mm-hmm.
Don't forget, this all takes place tonight at 7:30 at Walton Arts Center. For Ozarks at Large, I'm PJ Hrabowski.
W. Dell Warren is the conductor of the University of Arkansas Wind Symphony. He spoke with Ozarks at Large's PJ Hrabowski earlier this week.
It's Wednesday, November 17th, 2010. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Becca Bacon-Martin, the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
Tonight, something we don't talk much about, but they do a lot of in Fayetteville, there's a poetry slam at Arzy's Coffee House on the University of Arkansas campus in Fayetteville, featuring Mighty Mike McGee, who's nationally known, 7 o'clock, and it's my favorite word.
Free.
Also tonight, University of Arkansas at Fort Smith has a program of Latin American composers.
Yes, very interesting.
At 7:30 at the First Presbyterian Church in Fort Smith. It is also
free, not bad. Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
If you could read my mind, love, what a tale my thoughts could tell.
Gordon Lightfoot was born on this date in 1938 in Ontario, Canada. His first appearance at Massey Hall in Toronto was just before he turned 13 as the winner of a competition for boys with unchanged voices. After a background in barbershop quartets and as a member of a duo, Lightfoot struck out on his own in the early 60s. He had written about 75 songs when he was caught up in the country music scene and folk revival of the time. His music was discovered in 1964 when he was performing on the Toronto folk scene. Lightfoot recorded 5 albums for United Artists. Although he toured in the U.S. and in Canada during the 60s, his chart appearances were in Canada only. But following his first LP release with Warner Brothers, a disc jockey began to play one of the tracks from that album on the radio. If You Could Read My Mind was Lightfoot's breakthrough on the U.S. charts, reaching number 5, and was to become one of the most covered songs in popular music history. After some harder-edged music in the early 80s, followed by a very contemporary sound on his 1986 East of Midnight album, he returned to his acoustic roots and recorded 2 albums in the 90s with a sound more reminiscent of his very early recordings. Lightfoot has earned 5 Grammy nominations and 17 Juno Awards, and was inducted into the Canadian Music Hall of Fame in 1986. In 1970, he received the prestigious Order of Canada. In 1997, he received the Governor's General's Award, the highest official Canadian honor. And in September of 2001, he was inducted into the Canadian Country Music Hall of Fame.
A movie queen to play the scene of bringing all the good things out in me. But for now, love, let's be real.
The Nevada County Depot and Museum, located in the former Iron Mountain Railroad Depot in downtown Prescott, was put on the National Register of Historic Places on this date in 1978. The museum, founded in 1976 as the Nevada County State Park Association, is the only museum in Nevada County. It houses exhibits on early county history, Civil War battles fought in the area, and the railroad history of the county. It also posts rotating exhibits of photographs of daily life in the 1930s and 1940s. On this date in 1968, NBC outraged football fans by cutting away from the final minutes of a game to air a TV special, Heidi, on schedule. Viewers were deprived of seeing the Oakland Raiders come from behind to beat the New York Jets 43-32. Following this incident, television networks quit cutting away from professional sporting events until they were completed. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Tomorrow night, Arts Live Theater will open this week's run of Willy Wonka, the classic story of a lucky golden ticket, an eccentric candy mogul, and lessons learned by Charlie and his grandfather will be staged at the UARC Ballroom on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. Tomorrow, Friday and Saturday night, curtain goes up at 7. Saturday and Sunday afternoon, the performances are at 2. We invited one of the cast members, Gordon Allison, to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk about the show. Gordon plays Charlie's grandfather, a character made famous in the 1971 film version by Jack Albertson. Gordon, a sophomore at Fayetteville High School, says the Arts Live version of Willy Wonka has singing, lighting effects, and of course, Oompa Loompas.
Oh, yes, we have very interesting Oompa Loompas. They're not the classic kind, like in the movies, but instead, they're going to be, well, it'll be a surprise instead.
What attracted you to audition for this show?
Well, first, I just love Arts Live. It's really a fun place to meet friends and that sort of thing. Also, I just really like the story. I read the book as a child several times, and I just really thought it would be fun to act out a childhood memory sort of thing. I don't know.
Now, you have with art, this is not your first Arts Live appearance. Mm-hmm. If you look back over your body of work with Arts Live, you tend to play people that are not just older than you, mm-hmm. but considerably older, because you're in this production, you're Charlie's uncle.
Yeah. Grandfather.
Grandfather, right. Yes. Grandfather, see? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so you're Charlie's grandfather. You have played FDR.
Yes.
Who was considerably older than you are now.
Oh, yes.
And that was in Annie.
Yes, it was.
Some others, right? Where you played someone
of age? Played Uncle Henry, Dorothy's uncle, in The Wizard of Oz. And then I played a Goblin King in The Hobbit, and he was pretty old. He was pretty old in the book. Can't remember the exact age, but he was a couple hundred years.
So how do you get these roles? How do you get these roles where you're decades older than you really are?
I can easily change my voice. Sometimes it takes, but I can do just an assortment of voices that range from, like, I would, before auditioning for Annie, I wanted to be FDR, so I watched several of his speeches online to try to get a feel for his voice, and I was told I did all right on it. A little too Arkansan, but...
It's hard to get that New York accent in just a few weeks, I understand. What do you like about performing live? Because it scares me.
Oh, yeah, it is. I remember first play, the first showing of The Hobbit, opening night. I stepped out there, and I looked out, and I'm like, what am I doing? And then I'm like, oh, okay, I need to start. And then everything just kind of flowed right in, and it went well. So it's always the first time that's the hardest, and then you want to do that again. You just feel as though that's one of the best experiences to have, is just to be out in front of people performing, and you just want to do it again and again and again.
We'll graduate for a couple more years.
Right.
I'm sure this is a question that gets eye rolls, and if you want to eye roll in response to this, that's fine. Do you know yet what you want to pursue as a career? Is theater or acting something you're interested in, or could it be something else?
Well, I would like to act. I would. But it's one of those things where there's so many people who want to act, and like it's like someone saying, I want to be a football player in the NFL. So
a limited amount of jobs available, limited. Right, yeah.
So I would like to be an actor, but I also really like history a whole lot. I'm taking AP U.S. History block this year, and I'm actually liking the class. Others have told me how it's a horribly scary class, whereas I think the teachers are pretty nice, and the content is actually really interesting. So maybe something in teaching, and then like maybe local theater acting. I don't know, part time.
We'll break a leg and look out for that Veruca Salt.
Oh, all right.
She's a handful.
Oh yeah,
Gordon. Thanks.
Thank you.
Gordon Allison will play Charlie's grandfather in the Arts Live Theater production of Willy Wonka, opening tomorrow night at the UARC Bowl on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. The performance is directed by Missy Gibson and will be staged tomorrow night, Friday night, and Saturday night at 7, with Saturday and Sunday matinees at 2. Those attending will also be able to enter a raffle for a year's worth of chocolate. That translates to 365 chocolate bars from Nestle to be given away at Sunday's final performance. For more information, you can go to artslivetheater.com. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums, and for the next few minutes on our program, a little Jay music brought to us by our birdman, Joe Neal.
It's possible to go out in the woods in fall and never be far from blue jays. We are just blessed with lots of jays. I'm an unabashed aficionado of jays, and this is a great time to head out into the woods. Going for Jay music is what I say, to no one in particular. Never heard that CD? Well then please listen, it's Jay time. Here's something from the Jay Top 40, the pump handle. Notice how much it sounds like one of those old-fashioned water pumps, up and down, and needs to be oiled. The jays around my neighborhood are uncharacteristically quiet when they are nesting, but they are all done with that at the end of summer. Now in fall, essential jayness comes into flower. That's when they migrate in big numbers. Anytime between late September and early November, it's possible to see lots of jays moving south in low overhead flights. There can be small flocks of a few birds, up to hundreds, all heading south. It's a big jay ruckus when they swoop down into a woodlot like the one in my yard in Fayetteville. In migration, jays encounter all kinds of crows, cats, and hawks that arouse their interest. They are smart creatures, and they seem to enjoy mimicking. They really get the neighborhood aroused with such calls. Jays mimic a red-shouldered hawk in the following recording. Jays perform these hawk calls so frequently that it's become a joke among my birdwatching friends. We hear a hawk. Was it a hawk? Got $5 for a bet? Maybe it was a jay. We place our bets, then go for the perps, as they say in the cop shows, perpetuator of hawk calls. Frequently, we find no hawk. A couple of guilty-looking jays fly out of the bush. A red oak in my front yard has a record acorn crop. Jays fly off clasping brown acorns in their black bills. The distended throat I see means they are transporting more. By transport, I mean they are flying back and forth from my tree to the neighbor's yard. They are ferrying acorns to a secret stash or a cache in the ground. These caches are associated with an interesting hypothesis about how oak forests get planted. Seedlings of a new forest grow from acorns left or forgotten by jays. They're all around us, those busy musical jays.
Joe Neal's latest book is Birdside Baptists and Other Ornithological Mysteries. He's also co-author with Douglas James of Arkansas Birds, published by the University of Arkansas Press. Local support for Ozarks at Large comes from the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture.
Support is also provided by Handmade, located in the Evelyn Hill Shopping Center in Fayetteville, and celebrating the holiday open house on Saturday, December 4th. Refreshments will be served in gourmet foods, kitchenware, and custom-made gift baskets will be available. 582-5731 for more information. This is your public radio station, KUAF, 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Chester. KUAF is a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas.
And it's time again for the KUAF and Friends Holiday Giveaway. Thanks to our generous KUAF underwriters, it's our chance to give back to you. You could win a gift from Pack Rat Outdoor Center, Handmade, Dog Party USA, or your Total Fitness Shop, and more. Details and registration available on the web at KUAF.com. The drawing will be held Thursday, December 16th, during classical music with P.J. Hrabowski. Please, just one entry per person. Thanks and good luck. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Thanks so much for listening, and tune in tomorrow at noon for another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. And if you'd like to hear portions of this show again, you can go online to ozarksatlarge.com. Individual stories and full episodes are available there.